So, Chris, we're going to come to the time of colonisation, and we'd like you to talk us through how things were, what's happened since, and what might we learn.
Do I really need the microphone? Or could
for accessibility and
podcasting. For accessibility? Okay, well, thank you very much. I just thought I'd check with that. And thank you very much, Trish, Namani, everyone. And thank you very much for inviting me here to talk about the last 185 years. So I want to take you back to a specific point, to November 1836. And on that, or in that month, particularly in the late part of November, the Africaine, the bark from the United Kingdom, or from England, arrived here at Glenelg and disembarked. And on the Africaine was my three times great-grandfather. And his name was James Cronk. And I want you to look at what happened in Adelaide through his eyes. So he arrived here as an indentured servant to the immigration officer, John Brown, and he was originally on the manifest listed as an agriculturalist. But he jumped ship almost immediately and went straight into the country. And you can imagine what he saw of this completely unaltered landscape. As he was standing on the Africaine, he would have looked across at a variety of different ecosystems, of different plant assemblages across the Adelaide Plains. There was an amazing wetland area that would have been quite dry in November, but filled with large amounts of water over the winter time. And that was an area around Marion that stretched from Marion effectively to West Lakes and was known as the Reed Beds. And this wetland was extensively used by the Kaurna people as a food source, rich in bird life and a range of other animals. Up onto the hills, some parts of the hills were bare and grassland, other parts got to be very dense with stringy bark forests. There were the red gum forested areas that came down all of the creeks and streams that came onto the plains. And then up to the north you had the mallee, you had grasslands, and then there was the samphire swamps and the mangroves to the north. And of course there was the magnificent arc of sand dunes that extended really from Maslin's Beach all the way up to Semaphore. So there are all of these different environments. And he would have stood on the deck of the Africaine and looked across at this incredibly rich and verdant landscape. So the Adelaide Plains, Mount Lofty region was a green island, if you like, with more arid zones to the north and the east and obviously the oceans to the south and west. An extraordinary landscape. And in fact, it's a biodiversity hotspot, so it holds some 60% of the state's birds, 30% of the state's plants, and about 25 to 20% of the state's mammals, reptiles, amphibians and fish. All in an area that's a tiny fraction of 1% of the area of the state. Incredibly rich landscape. So he jumped ship and went straight and camped in the reed beds. It was a time that terrified him because he expected lions and tigers and elephants and all sorts of things to come out of the bush. Remember, virtually no white person had set foot anywhere near South Australia. Some sealers, maybe, Matthew Flinders, and obviously Nicholas Bourdin had stopped by briefly some 30 years before. But otherwise, this was really the first incursion. He was the first person to meet Kaurna people, and he found they were amazed to see him. He was very white and wearing really strange gear, and so they were pretty nervous. But he found them to be very friendly and very peaceful. And so he quickly fell in with them and exchanged bread and sugar for possums and cockatoos, which he traded and made quite a large amount of money out of, none of which came down to me. And he was the first person the first white person to cross the Mount Lofty Ranges, and he thoroughly enjoyed his time with Kaurna people. So much so that he was the first white person to learn Kaurna language, and he developed a dictionary. And from that dictionary, we now have 34 suburbs that have Kaurna names, and they vary from Aldinga and Wollonga, Cowandilla, Patualonga. There's even suburbs like Glen Unger, where the Unger means place next to, so it was next to Glen Osmond, so he wanted to live somewhere near Osmond Gillies, the wealthiest dude in the colony within the first few years. So, and those names have become part, obviously, of our culture. And he went on to be the official translator and wound up as assistant protector for the Aborigines. Sorry to use the term Aborigines, but that was his official title there. Which is odd. It's an odd thing to think of now, rather patronising title. But it also reflected that Edward Gibbon Wakefield and the formation of South Australia was meant to be a utopian society. And it was meant to deeply engage the First Nations people. The letters patent were prepared to give Aboriginal people the right of access across the whole area as equals. And this was incredibly unusual for the time. And in fact, James Cromp would translate the speeches of the governors into Ghana for the Aboriginal people who were present at the speeches. And this went on for about 4 years until he was eventually fired by Governor Gawler for finding Governor Gawler's long and turgid speeches untranslatable, he said. So Gawler didn't like that very much and he had to go. But what is interesting is that lasted only a few years. And very quickly, that sort of approach, that combined walking together approach, was lost. And it was lost for a number of reasons. Some of it was greed, as a large number of people had arrived here from not just the UK, but also Germany and other places. There was fear, and a lot of it became about the fear of the place. Loneliness and homesickness also kicked in. The fear bit is very interesting because they encountered plants and animals that were so different. They didn't like a lot of the plants because they were often spiky and prickly and unattractive. They didn't like the sound of the birds because they were raucous. The kookaburra, the red wattle bird, many of the cockatoos were not pleasant to the ears. And many of them were just scary. Like my friend here, which is Harry the Huntsman, and you would all have seen a huntsman at some stage. So this one is actually Delina cancerides. It's unusual in that it lives in large colonies, sometimes up to about 200 people. And you have a big female in charge of some 200 animals, and they live under bark, a big sheet of bark, the red gums. And if you peel back the bark, all 200 will rush out as fast as possible, running up and down the tree to really shock whatever is disturbing. They're sometimes called fountain spiders. Amazing animals. When you're getting off the Africa and you lean against a tree and 200 giant spiders come out, it looked the willies up. So they didn't like them. So they set about clearing the land. Now less than 8% of the Mount Lofties and Adelaide region is remnant vegetation. We have the highest extinction rate of vertebrates of pretty much anywhere in the world. Large numbers had gone by the end of the 1880s. We also imported huge numbers of plants and animals from the UK and from South Africa. There's some 1,500 introduced species of plants, some for agricultural purposes, but many for beautification. And many have strong connections to Europe. So we brought out oak and elm and plane tree, poplars, a whole range of plants and shrubs and so forth, oleander, because they reminded us of home. And the move then was to create a little England, if you like, really, where the sense of place for the people who come out here, their homesickness was alleviated by having these local plants from the UK. And we brought out many animals that were also from Europe. We introduced greenfinch, goldfinch, skylark, blackbird, sparrow, starling. All these things, when you look at them, have no right to be here. And it took deliberate and enthusiastic effort to introduce these, many of which have gone on to become feral. And then we know the stories of rabbits and foxes and others as well here. So we set about changing the landscape. And at the same time, as well as abolishing the natural landscape, we abolished the connection with Ghana. And Jack has made reference to that, a process that progressed all the way through to the stolen generations, the exemption certificates, and the loss of language. And we lost that connection. So we wound up with a little bit of UK and a continuing loss or disregard of the natural environment. And even coming here, I walked past Government House. Have a look at the trees in Government House. I could only find one native. It was a bottlebrush right at the front gate. And I spent about 10 minutes looking over the fence until they asked me to move on. I'm not even sure if that's a South Australian modern rush. All the rest are Norfolk pine, pepper trees, and Moreton Bay figs, and a whole range of others reflected the Englishness of the time and no interest to keep or even understand the South Australian environment. So it changed absolutely dramatically here. But there's been a real resurgence in understanding what sense of place means for Australians in the 21st century. And we have seen actually a return to understanding the local environments, to not think about the northern areas as swamplands, but as biodiversity-rich water recycling locations, and as really important to the operation of our community. We are starting to recognise the importance of species. We are looking at history now to tell us what's going to happen in the future, and I know that Kristen will come on to that topic. And there's been a lot of interest in what areas will flood as a result of climate change and so forth. And there is real big plans now to rewild many of the animals and plants that we have lost. Platypus back to the torrents, yellowfoot and rock wallabies up to the north, a major program on York Peninsula to bring back bilbies and betongs and all of these small mammals that were lost. And this can only happen with much greater connection with Aboriginal people. And to be part of the resurgence of Kaurna as a culture and as a language has been really important for us as a community. Natural environment, first peoples go together. They tell similar stories and have very similar outcomes. And engaging with both creates a much more interesting and inclusive society. So our sense of place now is still about Harry the Huntsman here. But whenever I tell stories and show this picture, if I'm telling it to a group like you, I can't tell because you've got face masks, but you're smiling. Everybody's got a story about a huntsman, in the letterbox or behind the sun visor of your car or the time Dad fell over a lounge chair trying to swat one, all of those things. Everyone has seen one. And in fact, we have a patented method for moving huntsman out of the house. You can have get a cup, you put it over the top, see, you're all nodding. Slide a sheet of paper, take it outside. You're all smiling, and that's because this means something to you. This is part of our sense of place. I gave this talk to a collection of visiting mayors from China a couple of years back. They looked at me like I had a disease, that I had come from the planet Zebob, and that no one in their right mind would even look at an animal like this, let alone collect it and put it outside. Our sense of place as Adelaideans, South Australians, are deeply connected to our own land, our own animals, our own environments, our own Indigenous people, and we are now starting to celebrate that as our culture and our sense of place. And this is incredibly exciting, and we've seen a lot of this start to happen just 2 weeks ago with the second Nature Festival. And Uncle Jack is an ambassador for the Nature Festival, 280 events, engaging people all around the state with their own environment through music and art as well as science. It's an incredibly exciting time to see the resurgence in interest in nature, First Peoples, and see this connection. And I think with that, I will finish.
Thank you, Chris. That's so interesting. Now I start my interaction with huntsmans by speaking to them before I move them, because I'm still quite terrified of something that comes from childhood, I think.